Are you in need of a pace clock? Looking to finally upgrade those ancient analog clocks? The Swim Nerd Pace Clock is the most innovative digital pace clock. It connects to your Swim Nerd mobile app, allowing you to program any set your heart desires. Except for 100-100s while listening to Nickelback. You can't program that. That is not allowed. If you haven't seen the Swim Nerd Pace Clock yet, go to swimpractice.com to check it out.
All right, I think we're going here, so... Yannick Agnel, welcome to the podcast. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk a lot about swimming.
Well, listen, honestly, you gave me the best response anybody's ever given me when I asked them if they would mind coming on the podcast. You just wrote back, "With great pleasure." And that made me so happy that you would say that. Thank you.
Well, it's always the case. You know, it's kind of... I can scarcely talk about swimming sports, okay, but swimming like on a technical level in general right now on my daily routine is a bit idle, I would say. Mm-hmm. So it's always a pleasure to see people that are like directly actors on an international level.
Well, no, thank you again. I appreciate your time. So tell us, where are you coming from right now?
Well, I'm living in Paris and having a lot of different things on my hands. Okay. Since I quit the swimming sphere, I didn't really, you know, drop out completely. I'm still commentating on TV, okay. You know, for France Télévision, as we say it in France. Mm-hmm. So every big event, I'm actually, you know, super close to all the people from the French swimming world and trying to encourage my team the best I can.
And beautiful.
So that's one part. I'm also giving conferences, lectures about many different things. Mm-hmm. I am coaching kind of an e-sport professional team as well.
Okay.
And many other things. I'm writing a lot. I've been there's a novel that I wrote that's been out since last year, and another one that's coming, and a translation from an American novel that I did during the lockdown. Like, the French lockdown period was super long. It was more than 2 months. So I had time to do that, and many other things.
Well, listen, that's kind of what I got from watching some interviews with you just in the research of talking to you today. I wanted to get to know you a little bit, and it seems like you are a very thoughtful person, that there was more to you than just being a swimmer. There was more to you than just swimming, even though a lot of us as swimmers or coaches saw your results and saw your ability and your talents. To me, it was you're more complex. You've got more layers than just being a swimmer. Would I be correct?
Well, I hope so. Well, the thing is, I think my performance in swimming was coming from having a balance in my life as well. And I've always been curious about a lot of different subjects, you know. So I guess that helps, yeah.
Well, what about your English? You know, you have one of the best English speaking accents for a French person that I've known. So how did you develop your English? Because a lot of the French people have very strong accents. Yours is quite mild.
Oh, I guess it's all right. It's super rusty. I'm sorry if I'm like, you know, looking for my words and everything, because it's been a while. I haven't actually spoken English like this in a very long time. But I guess, I don't know, I guess when you're on the when you're on tour, you know, swimming, and you have to meet with a lot of people, a lot of from a lot of different countries. I regret this time when, you know, French was the language of diplomacy. It's not the case anymore. So I had to put up with English. No, but I love languages in general. It's not the only language that I speak.
What else do you speak?
I would say a bit of Japanese, Chinese, Korean. I've tried to learn Russian and of course Spanish. That's like super close to where I used to live in France.
Wow. So, well, you're good in school. You seem like you must have done really well in school.
I was okay, I guess. Okay. Yeah. There's no real equivalent from you know, SAT to what we have, which is called baccalaureate in here. But it was enough, I guess, to maybe at some point make it to the Ivy League or something like this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was, I've always been interested. I don't really like to study. I like to learn, which is, to me, completely different.
Now, is that something that you felt like you applied to your swimming? Is that why you were able to, your progression was so rapid in the sense that you're an amazing junior, and then from juniors, you went straight into the seniors, and were you just always learning as a swimmer?
Well, I tried to, you know, for quite a long time, actually, I wasn't swimming, I wasn't training that much during the day, you know, it was not like super intense, especially when I was in high school. We were really paying attention to the fact that I was pursuing two different goals, the sports one and the school one. So I guess when I was in these 2 hours practice, you know, these sessions, I really wanted to make the best out of it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and which is, to me, the most important thing that you have to do when you actually swim and when you're at practice, you have to focus 100%. And, you know, it's like when you're working and you're in front of your computer, mm-hmm. you can do anything. You can watch, you know, like you can maybe be on Facebook or anything. But if you keep working and working and working and make this exact time valuable and actually efficient, well, you're going to learn quick at some point. So I guess every practice was for me the occasion to really be super efficient. And then I think that even though it's supposed to be an individual sport, it never really is, you know, like it's all about the surroundings. So of course, all my teammates, my coaches and the staff.
Well, listen, my friend, I was on the pool deck in 2012. I was actually representing the Bahamas in 2012. I had a girl that swam in the 50 and the 100 freestyle. So I was there with the Bahamas. But I had many athletes that I've coached in the past. And one of my former athletes was Fred Brusquet. So I have a close affiliation with the French team, and I know them very well. But I was shocked in 2012 when I first saw you. I'd never seen anybody... especially once I saw you swim the 200 freestyle, I hadn't seen anybody that dominant in a very long time. I mean, you dominated the best swimmers in the world, and it shocked me. I was like, holy shit, who is this kid? I mean, I knew who you were, but my God, it was like this burst of talent that had just emerged. And I thought you were going to be one of the most dominant swimmers for many, many years. And so what I want to do is I want to talk about kind of pre-2012. I'd like to talk about 12 a little bit, and then obviously post and some things that happened there. And then how old are you today right now?
I'm 28.
28. So you should still be, in my mind, one of the most dominant swimmers in the world, but you've been retired for a few years now. So it's a fascinating story, really. So talk to us about... before 2012, you know, like who were you and how did you develop into this person that I saw on the pool deck in 2012, this amazing monster of a man that swam at the Olympics? But tell me about yourself.
You know, I guess I was just one of these kids that really was dreaming of the Olympics since a very young age. My very first memories of the Olympics is actually on Instagram. I sent a message to Jan Thorpe about it, because he is my very first memory of swimming ever. And when I saw him swimming the 400 and the relays 200, etc., I was like, wow, I want to be in there. I want to be in the box. I want to be on the box, and I will do anything, you know.
Was this first memory from 2000 or 2004?
2000. Mm-hmm. 2000. And then it's like, you know, it was like maybe like a child's dream, you know, when you want to be, I don't know, a firefighter or whatever, you know, archaeology, mm-hmm. anything. And well, it turned out that my parents, you know, I lived in the south in a small city called Nîmes.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody kind of around me was lucky enough to have the occasion to build a pool. So I had to learn how to swim in order not to drown, right? So that's what happened. I went to the club of this little town, and directly they told me there's something to do. You know, you have maybe you might have some abilities. You have a kind of a, you know, like very lanky posture, body, and we might be able to do something about it, right? So I trained hard, and it went super fine from the very first meet that I attended to then, you know, from a very regional level to then national and then international. So at some point, I felt like it was too little for me to keep learning and staying in Nîmes. And so I had to go to Nice. So I moved there in the squad of Fabrice Pellerin.
What year was this?
In which, it was 2006. 2006, okay. I think, yeah.
Okay.
So I was 14. Mm. And then really started the serious matter.
And what was your first impressions of training with Fabrice? How did it go initially?
Well, he called my parents saying like, hey, might be a good thing to, you know, like test Yannick at some point. Like he comes to Nice, trains with us for a day, and then you choose, you know? And so that's what we did. And I arrived there and it was all palm trees and super blue sky and the sea, and everybody was like super nice. And they were, you know, international level swimmers at the time, you know, Camille Muffa, for example, she was already almost on top. Right. So I was super amazed. And I felt like I belonged there, really.
How would you describe the training and the progression as you got older and as you became, you know, this world junior swimmer and into kind of an Olympic swimmer closer to 2012? What type of training were you doing in France?
I think it was a very special one, even for France, even for that exact time, you know, that exact era of swimming, because we weren't swimming as much as the other people. I think it was more quality than quantity, and Fabrice was focusing a lot on the technical aspect of swimming, so of the practice. So it was all, you know, like these very, very precise exercises that if I tell you things like we were like swimming with one finger or nothing at all and having these, you know, paddles with different sizes and swimming with music, for example, at the rhythm, the exact rhythm of the music that we had to reproduce, and all these kind of very funny drills that in the end got us to be, I think, one of the, like technically speaking, one of the best squad in the world. So, and it wasn't too much, which is something that sometimes happens, you know, when you see somebody that has potential and you want she or he to you know, like progress at a super a rapid scale. It wasn't too much of training, and I think that was great. I only started doing any, you know, dryland sessions by the age of I don't know, maybe 16, 17, something like this.
Oh, wow.
Not even before 17, 18.
And the dryland was what kind of type of work were you doing?
When I'm talking dryland, I'm not talking about like core, you know, exercises like the plank or stuff like this. I'm talking about real like gym stuff,
like lifting weights,
like lifting weights and stuff like this. Yeah.
Okay.
So that didn't happen until very late in my career, and I think it's a good thing. It should be, you know, it was more like swimming was the main block. And then anything around it can like come and enriching it, you know, it can be very enriching. Would it be dancing or boxing or anything like this? You know, it was going very far on the sport scale to be super efficient in the water.
Okay.
So I don't think it works with everybody, but with the my personality, I think it was really, really a super nice years to experience.
What type of coach athlete relationship did you have with Fabrice in the lead up to 2012? How did your relationship develop over the years?
Fabrice was always somebody that was very, very secret, not really talkative, you know. He was really a true technician. Maybe, in my opinion, one of the best, if not still the best in the world. And we had, we wanted the victory, you know, we wanted it. So every time was a good time to train. So when I got done with high school, we really focused a bit more on swimming and on the performance itself, and every occasion was good. So we did something that was super new in France back then, and we swam on Sundays, stuff that nobody did in France back then. But Fabrice was also somebody that was, in my opinion, the core problem of the coaching in general in any sport in France right now. You know, it's not like in the States. When I got to the States, the very first time, you have a lot of people around the deck, right? Mm-hmm. You have the coaching, the assistant, the guy that's taking care of dryland, the physio, mm-hmm. anybody, you know. In France, it doesn't work like that. In France, we have a real, you know, they really sacralize the relationship that you have between the coach and the athlete. And that can lead to, it's like a real, like a love relationship, a love affair. So at some point, after 10 years of being together 6 to 8 hours a day, it's kind of hard to be able to change habits and to see things from a distance. And with Fabrice, that was what happened. It was kind of he was holding the entire group as kind of a guru, because everybody was putting everything in his hands and he had to do everything by himself. To me, I was probably like 300 miles away from my parents, you know, which in France is kind of, a long walk.
Yeah.
And he was like my dad. He was the friend. He was, you know, the coaching figure. He was the physio. He was the guy that was taking care of dryland. He was everything. And everybody is putting the power into the hands of the head coaches there. So sometimes that leads of these people, you know, having a lack of self criticism.
You know? Gotcha. Yeah. So it's very much about it's control as well. That's very controlling.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So we felt like we were the very best in the world, which was Fabrice's power to give us, you know. We felt like nothing could stop us, but in the meantime, he was also a lot of he was really controlling us totally. And I think he's not the only case, and I think that's part of the reason why in France it works out super well, because you can attain a lot of like really the high spheres in sports very easily. Because you're creative, because you're given space and you have the entire power. So if you're good, it's going to be super good because you have everything in your hands. But in the same time, on the same hand, you know, it just cannot possibly last super long because you're exhausting the athletes that you're coaching. So to me, that's the main problem. And that's one of the reasons why I, but also a lot of other French swimmers were super successful at some point, never really did know how to last super long, you know, in the game. So what you were referring to is quite right. It's quite right.
Look, and I bring it up because I've heard things from different people. You hear about certain relationships and challenges, and And that was certainly something that comes up a lot with different people in terms of they always talk about the relationship that you had with Fabrice and how controlling it was. And I kind of just wanted to get your perspective on it because, I mean, like you said, in a way, those things can be good. You know, when somebody has control of all the different variables and they're very good at managing those things, that can be a good situation at times. But it can also be very bad when you're under somebody's spell, when you're under somebody's control. It's all consuming. They think it's almost like you're they own you. It's like a piece of you're a piece of furniture that they own. So it can get to a point where it's very negative on the athlete as well, where I feel owned by this person.
Well, it's very true. But you know that, so that's why I started with saying the good things, because it wasn't only the bad stuff, right?
Sure.
There's a reason why we, with Camille and Clément, went to be like Olympic champions at some point. And it wasn't only, super bad moments in the pool, but you're right. When you're creating this kind of environment, you know, I remember one interview of Fabrice where he was explaining the guy that he was the tree and we were the branches, right? So you're like, really? Wow. And some other interviews where right after my two titles in London, he was explaining that I had no talent, but I had ambition. You know, this kind of stuff that you read on the newspaper when it's like your shining moment, you know, at some point you're like, okay. I don't want this to go public, you know, and obviously it's not everything is like super white or super black, you know, it's always a bit in between. But that's why I was explaining this. I don't think that Fabrice is the only one that does that. I don't think
that. I think it's a cultural issue in France then.
I think it can be, yeah. I think it can be. Mostly because a lot of parents go like, you take my kid, make it a champion, you know, which wasn't my case, but my parents were super far from Nice.
Yeah, sure.
So they had no, like when I was, you know, I had them on the phone, they were like, okay, no, I was like, everything is going well, don't worry. And then I just hung up and started crying, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I guess you have a lot of things to change on this matter, and they are slowly understanding, I think, right now, that things can be done in another way. And I don't think we have enough control on the clubs, on the coaches themselves, to prevent this kind of stuff from happening. I don't know if it ever happened in the States as well. I hope not.
Yeah, well, I think there are instances, sure, but I think there are, you know, there are situations now that have come to light where those things are almost impossible to have a situation like that now in America because of all the safeguards that they have in place. So I think the culture has shifted for sure in terms of how much power a coach can have over one particular athlete. You know, there's a lot of checks and balances these days. Yeah. So we'll talk to us about 2012 then, because obviously you do have an incredible performance there. And so in the days leading up to 2012, I'm always interested in the psychology as well. So in the days leading up to it, are you feeling ready to win? Are you feeling dominant?
Oh yeah.
What's happening? Yeah.
Oh yeah. That was incredible. Well, it wasn't only, a gently flowing river at the time, but I think it started a bit earlier than 2012. It started at the World Championships in Shanghai in 2011. I came up with being fifth in the 200 freestyle, I think. I think I was fifth, and in like,
yeah, you were, there was fifth everybody in that, and in sixth race. In the 400, sixth in the 400, yeah. Fifth in the 200. Yeah.
So I, because of this relationship that I had with my coach and the fact that I wasn't feeling well at all, and I wasn't taking care of myself, I didn't have the balance that I was talking to you about, you know, with the study side, because I just left high school, etc. That was a lot coming up. Yeah. coming up. And so I, well, I got very sick, sick in a, what you call that, a pneumonia, I guess. Mm-hmm. In a, so I had that, and I had that, and I only stayed at home for like a week, and then I was back in the water, you know, spitting, spitting blood in the water and training anyway. And like Fabrice telling me, like, you know what, now we don't stop for you. It's either it it goes or it breaks, right? Mm. So I was like, wow, okay, well, let's hope it doesn't break. You know, you have a coach telling you this, you know, and he's the only fatherly figure that you can have around. So you're like, well, I hope it doesn't break. So so it went pretty bad in 2011. But then I knew that I was able to be the best at this point, because I was like, it was actually a good performance. I think I was minute 44, 99, something like this. Something that would get you to be probably a world champ or an Olympic champion around now, you know?
Yeah, sure.
But then all the guys that were in front of me, they were like, you know, the best of the best. So so it was Michael, Ryan, I guess Paul Biederman and Taewon Park as well.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So that was just the best among the best. So I was like, you know, we're going to do something. Fabrice go and sees me at the end of the week. He was like, you know what we're going to do next year? You remember this TV series called Heroes?
Yeah, sure.
You know, where they have like superpowers and mm-hmm. The bad guy, his name is Siler. He goes and kills them and drains their power, you know,
yeah.
One by one. Mm-hmm. This is exactly what we did. I was like, okay, we're going to take this one guy. What's his superpower? For Taewon Park, for example, it was the turns. He was super good at turning. So I was like, okay, let's go. I'm going to do at least as good as him. Then what was Michael's and and Ryan's superpower? Underwater. So I was okay. I'm going to train. Even if I'm not the best at underwaters, at least if I'm just not bad, I'm going to be able to catch them. And if I'm like just 1 meter behind them, I'm going to be able to, because I knew that I was better than them swimming. My speed was, I was just faster in the swimming phase. I knew that I would be able to catch them, which wasn't possible before that on the 200, because I was getting too far and I didn't have the time to catch the wave and be able to pass. So this is what we did. We trained on every phase that I sucked at the time. The turn, the underwater, the start was really bad. I'm more than 2 meters high, which makes 6'8", something like this.
Mm.
And I was not explosive at all. So I had to work on all of these parts, which is what we did this precise season from 2011 to leading up to London. And then every meet was going well. It was going super well because I actually dealt with Fabrice at this time, telling him, okay, we're doing this, but I don't want to repeat what happened in 2011. So I'm going to have half a day per week where I'm actually going to a business school. So I went to a business school in Nice and attended some of the classes. And it was super nice. So it brought me a balance. I knew what I needed in swimming. It was super nice. And all the meets went super well. We had this, you know, it's not the same in France than in the US. We have our nationals in March or April. So very early in the season stage.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're qualifying, you know, they're qualifiers for the Olympics. So usually you just try to get in a super good shape, maybe 2 weeks before, you know, you start slowing down and actually prepare for nationals, because if you miss them, it's like, it's over. We didn't stop. What we did was we didn't stop, because Fabrice was pissed at the fact that in the US, you guys didn't really need to stop, and you could have an entire year of actual work and progression, and arriving in summer, you could start actually, you know, going a bit slower and gaining energy. So we didn't stop. We stopped maybe, you know, like 2 days before. I stayed there 3 days, got my tickets, and then on the road to London. 3 weeks before London, we had this meet that was called Open EDF, EDF, that would take place every year, you know, in France. Sure. Sometimes you guys would show up there. I remember Michael being there, everybody. So especially for sprinters, it was a good time.
Yeah.
And I had probably the worst meet of my life. I remember swimming hardly, really. It was just such an, I was in a like total pain. The 200 freestyle in a minute and 51 seconds, something like this. I was like,
wow.
Okay,
wow, that is bad.
Wow, that was super bad. I was like, hey, Fabrice, I guess it's time to, you know, at some point I have to rest maybe, because it's going to be hard. And we got into a big fight at this point. And then after a day or two, we're like, okay, back on tracks. And now it's like focus on the Olympics. And it went super well. We were in such disposition. I was, you know, there's Morpheus in Matrix. That is saying, you know, you're not the best when you are. I only know it in French. I don't know what it actually.
Say it in French. It must sound good in French.
Tu n'es pas le meilleur quand tu le crois, mais quand tu le sais. You're not the best when you believe it, but when you know it, you know. I really knew I was the best. Really, at this point, I was like, nobody can alter my confidence, and it was only good stress. And I was actually benefiting from the fact that Clément and Camille, which I was training with for the past, I don't know, like more than this, 7 years, six yeah. years, something like this. They knew what the Olympics were like. They knew what to avoid. The fact that you know, you have all these like free food away that you can use, these sodas, etc. They knew how to optimize everything, right? So I actually grew up listening to their advice, you know, and that turned out to be really, really helpful at the time.
Amazing, great stuff. All of that was incredible. I get all that too, and then that makes a lot of sense. But the part that I don't get is that you are racing the greatest athlete in the sport's history. You're racing Michael Phelps. So how do you, as a first-time Olympian, truly believe that you're going to stand up next to the blocks? I understand your training was going well. You feel confident. You're 6'8". You're a big man. You've got your teammates. You've got a great coach. But when you stand up on the blocks next to Michael Phelps, that's something completely different, correct?
Well, no, it didn't exactly arrive on like this, you know. It didn't really happen this way. The thing is, I never was afraid of anybody, and more than this, I never had any idol. You know, I didn't have a poster of Michael in my bedroom saying like, "I wish I was like him," etc. He was one of the most inspiring people in my entire life. I was like, okay, like he's an inspiring guy, but I'm Yannick Agnel, and I just want to be Yannick Agnel, and I knew what I was worth. But the thing is, the very first time actually that I raced Michael was in 2010 at the Open EDF I told you about. It was right after my the equivalent of the SAT exam, so it was an entire week. I didn't really swim so this week, and I was kind of on taper, kind of, you know, when I arrived at the Open EDF, and Michael was not, and so we had this 200 free, and I won, and you know, it was not that it was a big deal for me, but I was like, okay, so I'm able to do that. And retrospectively, when we talked about this with Michael, he was like, you know, like, I don't let anybody beat me ever, no matter the shape that I'm in, right? So that was something that really was struck him at the time. You know, it was like, wow, who's this kid?
Sure.
So knowing all of this, knowing all of this, what happened is in the 2 years that was, you know, going on, I learned something that's probably one of the most important lessons ever in the world of sports, which is, it's not because it's the Olympics that the people you're swimming against are different. You know, they're exactly the same people that I met when I was swimming at Worlds, some of them at European Championships, you know, and even in French Championships. And what we did was, during this year, this exact Olympic year, we even went to a training camp in Fort Lauderdale with Fabrice and a few other French swimmers. And then we participated in the Winter Nationals. So yeah. I think I won the 200, 400, something like this. And maybe it made a big impression. So we made sure that they knew me as well as I knew them back then.
Okay.
So arriving at the Olympics, I wasn't afraid. I wasn't afraid because I knew what I was worth. I knew that the last time I met those guys, I wasn't on my full, really potential and best shape. And that was it. Now I was ready.
Well, that makes perfect sense. And it's great advice for first time athletes going to next year's Olympics too. So really, really good answer there. So you are picked, I guess. Did you swim in the morning relay, or were you just go straight to the final? You went straight to the final. So you're picked to anchor the French relay. Was it on the first night?
Yeah, it was. It was on the first night.
4x1. You're at the back. How does that feel when they tell? Did you plan this in advance, or was this something they put on you on the day?
You mean that I anchor the relay, right?
Sure.
I can't remember exactly, but I knew that I was going to be, you know, at French Nationals, what we do is that we have two spots, right?
Yeah.
To qualify for the individual part. And the guys that are, generally speaking, the two highest on the box in the end, they're going to be in the relay, you know, on the evening, right?
Yeah, sure.
Because they're in the best shape, so and they're the fastest. So I knew somehow that I was going to be either first or last in the relay in position. But no, everything was decided in between during the day. So it was just being, you know, free to talk with anybody and just getting ready for the night. What was really back then, but I wasn't there again, so I don't know exactly how it happened, but what was really something that everybody talked about was Clément being in third position with me, because he might not be at this time the choice that everybody was going to make. We had Alain Bernard, you know, we had all these guys that were like super fast, Jérémy Stravius, and Fabrice fought for Clément to be in third position because he was in the shape of his life. He knew the guy from the States very well. He had this, you know, relay culture, the way we call it in France. Mm-hmm. You know, like you guys really have in the States, really have this culture of the relay that we really envy you so much.
Sure.
So he was there. And we trained 2 years together, you know, and he was on my ass all the time, you know. I was there and he was laying right after me, and he was, you know, like making it super, super heavy for me every day at practice. So I knew there was a synergy and I knew it was going to work. And there was something else about this relay. The entire year, it was, I think that was the biggest mistake, maybe. It was all about the American team and the Australian team that was blazing at the time, that were just fighting each other through newspapers or social media. They were like, no, I'm the best. And we were like, okay, let's not say anything, you know? We will let the time talk, right? We will let the swimming talk. So and that was one of the best words of advice from Fabien Gillot, which was the captain of the team back then. And he told us, you know, don't lose your energy. Don't, you know, waste your energy trying to fight with these people. The real answer is in the water. So
excellent. Good advice.
I think it's a very good advice.
Yeah.
So we got to the waiting room, you know, right before the relay. And we were like, you know what? Let's just have fun. It should be all about fun. We have nothing to lose. And I think we repeated this sentence maybe 100 times because Clément was like livid, you know, it was like all white and we're like, okay, it's going to be fine. You know, it's going to be all right. We had such a crew, you know, Fabien was like the super captain that always has the good words and that was going to be ready. We had Amaury Levaux, which was our kind of, what's his name? You know, the guys from the Chicago Bulls, the crazy one.
Like Dennis Rodman?
Dennis Rodman, yes. He was our Dennis Rodman, for sure, 100%. That was our Dennis Rodman. So, I mean, he was crazy, but we knew every time we had to count on him, he was there, you know?
Sure, yeah.
And that was super important to us. And then there was Clément and I, so the last two, Clément benefited really from his time in the States. He swam at USC, I think.
Yeah.
And then came back to France a year or two before the Olympics. And then we trained together and we knew it was going to be all right.
Well, listen, from your best memory, take me through it because you stand up on the last leg, you stand up on the blocks, you look across and Ryan Lochte's next to you, but you're behind. I mean, your team is behind at that stage and not just a little bit behind. You're a good half a body length behind going into the last 15 meters. So as your swimmer is coming in, what are you thinking? And then maybe as you enter the water during the race, what's happening?
Reality is when Clément touches the panel, we're not that behind. It's just that I'm taking a terrible, terrible start. And Ryan is so fast underwater that he takes me like a meter or so, you know? And the first thing that comes to my mind is really through, you know, the Swedish goggles that I had, seeing him, you know, just getting away. And I was like, well, gotta go with the arms. And then I'm just, you know, like pop, 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 swimming as fast as I can. And what was critical back then is what I was telling you about turns and underwater. And so what I did and what we worked on for the entire year turned out to pay off because at the turn and then the underwater, he didn't take me like that much, really.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I it wasn't one of my best underwater parts ever in my entire life, but it was enough for me to be able to catch him up and still see him, having him in my field of vision and be able to just.
So as you come out of the underwaters off the turn, you do look across and you do see him?
I see him and I know that I'm gonna, you know, little by little, just, you know, like crawl. And I see at some point that I'm actually, you know, passing, you know, really, I'm just in front of him at some point. I'm ahead.
Are there any words? What's the words in your head right now?
I don't have any words. You know, this is one of the things that some of the journalists ask you when you're out of the water in the mixed zone. And they're like, what did you think? What did you think during the race? And most of the swimmers, they would be like, nothing. It's not that you think of nothing. It's just that, consider this. Do you ever ask a pianist what he thought during his, you know, concert that he actually gives? Never happens. For one main reason, you're so focused on what you're doing that it's almost like meditating, right? It's a kind of meditation. You're so focused on one point that nothing else around you actually matters. And it was one of these races where you're really in the zone and it's like you go out and it's super easy. You don't even feel tired. But the thing was, when I knew that I was going, getting in the first place, I always use my my practice goggles. I don't have new ones that are like super shiny and without, you know, any scratches. I use my practice goggles because I feel good in them. You know, I know I feel good. I feel super comfortable, and this is one of these things. You know,
I like that.
Well, it prevented me from one thing. Prevented me from seeing actually past him. I couldn't see what the Australian guys, the Russian guys were about. You know, I didn't know where they were. So I was like, I have to stay focused because I know for me, it's going to be all right. But I don't know if actually next to him, these guys are like so ahead. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I touched the wall, and I actually have never seen the screen with the time. I still don't know if we're first or not. Maybe it's an entire gigantic scam and everybody's been lying to me for 8 years. But I just look at them and I see them exploding with joy and everything. I was like, okay, so this is fine. We made it.
We won. We won that one. Was there a point in the last 5 meters or 10 meters where you held your breath? Was that something that you practiced into the wall, or did that just come automatic at that point?
I can't remember. I really can't remember. What I do remember is that I think I was swimming. I was breathing every two strokes.
Sure.
Which is, I think so. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, every two strokes. Well, I think it was every two strokes because that probably was the way I trained, you know, the way I trained.
Sure.
That was allowing me to do this. We were training a lot, you know, a very long distance. And I came from the 400, you know, before 2011, I was always competing on the 400.
Yeah.
Even at Worlds. And it turned out to be super bad because I wasn't mastering it as well as I was doing on the 200, and it was taking really a lot of my energy out on the very first day or 2 days, you know, because it's always at the very beginning of the week and you have the relay right after it, and then the 200, and then other relays, etc., etc. So we figured with Fabrice that I should focus on the 100 and 200 only, and it would give me the occasion to compete individually on two races and then on three different relays. So that was a lot of chances of medals, you know.
Well, listen, incredible result, incredible relay. It takes a lot of energy out of you. It takes a lot of, you've got to go through all the media. You've got to go through the drug testing. You've got to, you know, a long day. And then you've got to come back and swim the 200 freestyle. And then you put together one of the most incredible performances I've ever seen in Olympic history. The 200 freestyle, like I said, it was one of the most dominant swims I've ever seen. So talk to me about the strategy here. What was the thought going into this race?
Well, the strategy at the very first, the heats and the semifinals was, to be able to qualify without giving too much energy into it, you know?
Okay.
So we had precise times in our head that I needed to realize. And I swam then to the 10th of the second.
Oh, wow.
Of a second. So that was super precise. And I felt so ready. You could have given me any time in your head. And I was like on a 50 and I would do it, you know, within the 10th of a second. So, So that's what we did. I can't remember exactly what the times were, but it was like 1:46 in the morning, 1:45 in the semis. And then we got to the final. The guy that I was most afraid of was Sun Yang by the time. And he was right next to me. I had the chance not to be in the fourth lane. I like to be just a bit on the side. When you're too much the center, the focus of the attention of everybody, sure. I don't think it's a good thing.
Yeah.
And it means that you get a lot of energy. It's either that you give a lot of energy to get to this seed in the final, or that you're so above everybody else that you can allow yourself to be in that position, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But that wasn't my case, really, because it was, I mean, the adversity was insane by then, insane. So I read an interview, or was it a tweet or something, from, once again, Ian Thorpe, a few weeks back from now, that was actually telling that he was saying that nobody these days knew how to swim a 200 freestyle. And I kind of agree with him. There is only one way to dominate and win a 200 freestyle. It is...
That was on my podcast, by the way. He did that on my podcast.
Oh, that was you? Well, that was... I thought it was incredible.
I'll send it to you after this.
Well, that's perfect. I saw it on Twitter and I was like, wow, that is... Like, this guy doesn't speak often, but when he speaks the truth. Because I felt exactly the same. And when I'm watching swimming now, the only guy that knows kind of how to swim in 200 freestyle, it's Danas Rapsis. He's the only one. In my opinion, he's the only one.
Uh-huh.
And you know what? If it wasn't for him to have, you know, shaken a little bit the blocks in Gwangju, he would have won. And I remember being on the media stands and telling all of my French friends, this guy is going to win. I know it. This guy's going to win because he's the only one who actually can swim a 200. And turns
out,
it's
about attacking the front end. Is that what you're saying?
It is. It is. You take the reins of the race from the very first 50 meters, but you have to do it in a timing that allows you, especially from the 100 meters, from the half of the race, to be able to come back. And it is a very special timing. So you don't have to, like, the thing that you must not do, is going too fast on the first 50. Like, when I take the reins of the race on the 200 freestyle, I'm not doing it by a meter, you know, by a real length, you know. It's just like, I know I'm in front of everybody, and I know I can take it back at some point, you know. I think I was maybe 50.9, 51 seconds at the 100 meters. I think it's where you should be if you want to swim a minute and 43 seconds, or even faster than that if you have enough energy on the last 50. But what I remember from it is we worked on it so much at practice, so much. We had this this rhythm thing. I don't know the word in English, actually, the thing that you know, the guitarist use to have the tempo.
Oh yeah,
you know? Metronome. Okay, that's the same thing, right? So we had this under our swimming cap and being on the metronome to have like the right. So I knew exactly, it was like exactly like in practice, and then you forget about practice, exactly like the pianist. You forget about the practice, but you just have to feel it, right? So we're getting there. And after the first 150 meters, I'm like, okay, now I'm like Maximus, you know, I'm unleashing hell, you know? and it was incredible. I touched the wall, I touched the panel, and I remember the first thing that comes to my mind is, wow, the time is not bad, but I could have done better if only I thought about, you know, accelerating the rhythm and the pace a bit earlier during the race, which is, I'm not sure it would have worked the same way, but yeah, it was that. And the second thought was, well, actually, you can do it, and actually not being on drugs. Not, you know, you can do it and being absolutely clean, you know, clean sport exists.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Oh, no doubt about that, for sure.
If you're in France, I'm telling you, it's not an easy thing to explain to everybody.
Well, I mean, you certainly had your run-ins with people that have been accused now of drugs. I mean, Sun Yang finished second in that race, and now he's obviously got a situation where he's been banned for 8 years. How do you feel about that? What's your personal opinion on that?
Well, first thing first, Sun Yang and Taewon Park were two guys. Every time I spent some time with them, not really speaking any bits of Mandarin or Korean at the time, they were super nice. They were really nice guys. I liked them. And the first time I saw Sun Yang was in Shanghai, and he was like, we're about the same height, and he was as clumsy as I am. So he gets into the conference room at the end of the race, and he gets, you know, he almost falls because of all the wires that are, and I was like, okay, he looks friendly to me. So yeah. Every time I had to be with these guys, I was like, well, they're really nice, always inviting me, you know, they're trying to speak, to share some stuff. Mm-hmm. I had good moments with them. Actually, there was one thing that made me laugh with Sun Yang, and it was in Barcelona in 2013. We are at the call room right before the 4x2, the final, and so there's a Chinese team. I don't know anybody except him in the Chinese team, and he sees me and he takes me in his arms, and he tells me this very clear one sentence. He looks at me in the eye and is like, KO Americans, KO Americans. And I was like, okay, buddy, I'm going to try. I'm not sure if I'm going to try. And well, he had a hell of a race this time. So about the doping situation. Well, first of all, you know, it's always complicated because with this, especially China, you know, and Russia and all these countries, you always have suspicions when you're, sure. I don't know about you guys, but when you come from France, you're like, it's so clear everything that happens in here that that it's hard not to believe this kind of stuff. But then again, I don't know what happened. I wasn't there, and so it's hard to be taking extreme positions on the matter. What I do know, though, is that we are not making enough efforts to stop this thing. For example, in any case in France, if you get caught with I don't know, like using stuff for the flu or anything, you take one year, maybe less.
Yeah,
but I firmly believe that if you take nandrolone or EPO, you know, I don't know how you say that in English, actually. I'm not sure it's EPO. The stuff
EPO,
that,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. EPO, yeah, yep. Right? Well, if you take this, it's not because you had a flu, okay? Yeah. So in my opinion, you have two samples. Only 2 years is just definitely not enough. And you know what? Two samples is two chances, right? So I would be way firmer than this on the actual doping thing, way firmer than this. So once again, talking about doping in general, we knew, especially in 2016, we knew that there were a lot of people, Russian people, Sun Yang, etc. We knew that there was something going on, but if you get on the deck and on the day of competition thinking like, oh, this guy is doping this one, he's not correct either, like you just get paranoid, and I think it can affect your performance in a bad way, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So I don't think as an athlete I wanted to focus too much on this, and I knew that it's a little bit like in Karate Kid, you know, at some point, even if you cheat, if you do things the right way, well, you end up winning, you
Yeah.
What I don't like though is that right now, all these guys that are, you know, that have their medals and titles taken off, well, the guy that should have won is only receiving it through FedEx, and he doesn't have his anthem, you know, and his like moment of shine on the on the podium, and and you know the sponsors, and it can affect a lot of stuff. So it's not right. It's definitely not right. But I just think we're not hard enough on the on really the sentence.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's a good answer, and I appreciate you being open to answer it and not just deflecting it. But it is complicated, you know. Like you said, you weren't there. It's very difficult. I mean, I raced for many years on the Australian team and at a couple of Olympics. And sure, you always have your doubts on certain people. And then there were certain people that got busted. And so, but you just never know. And you can't spend time wasting your energy on figuring out if, when, how, whatever. And, you know, you leave it in the hands of the people that it needs to be in their hands to sort it out. But at the end of the day, I guess Sun Yang is paying the consequences now. But you came out on top, you know, you're the Olympic champion. So that must feel good.
So that's the thing, you know, it's easier for me to say things like this when I know I won. Maybe I would have a different speech if I came up second. So so it's always the same thing. You know, it's never easy, but you're right. He definitely paid the consequence. And it's not the first time that something happened with him as well.
Yeah.
So
on
the matter. So, well, it's the karma, I guess.
I guess so. I came back to get him in the end. Do you think the world record is achievable? Do you think that can be broken in the 200?
Well, anything is, like any record is made to be broken at some point.
Do you have any regrets on that one?
No.
No.
The only one I have regrets on in the 400 one. I think it's totally achievable. And I think I could have done it.
What is it now? Is it 39?
No. I think it's still
40?
340 something.
340, yeah.
00, okay. Something like this. And I knew inside of me that I had this barrier to be broken, really. But when we focused on the 200, that it was the best choice. So I couldn't argue with that.
Have you had any interaction with Ian Thorpe? Are you friends? Do you know each other in any way?
We met once. In Germany, and it was a super nice dinner. I don't even know if he remembers that. And then it was only maybe just saying hello at one meet and hello there at another. But no, never really. And I felt like these guys, all these guys from the same generation, they were really, in my mind, in my thoughts, they were really classy, really thoughtful, really classy. And they had, you know, you were talking about having something else than the pool to show to the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what they had. This Peter van den Hogenbaum, you know, Ian Thorpe, you know, all these guys.
Alex Popov,
Alex Popov, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, listen, I did tell you this was going to go for an hour, and I'm really loving this conversation. Fine. Are you okay if we keep going?
Me too.
Okay, great. Because there's too much to talk about with you. It's incredible, incredible. And you're giving so much detail. I'm very thankful.
Let me just plug in my charger.
Yeah, that would be helpful for sure. Because we're going to go a little longer here, all right? This one's going to be a longer one. Loving chatting with you. It's amazing. Thank you.
Let's do that.
Listen, I'm not exactly sure of the time that it happened. Out of respect, I'll put it in your hands. But obviously, the death of your teammate Camille Muffet had a big impact on French swimming, and obviously you. How was that to deal with at the time?
It was hard. I was in Mulhouse, so back from Baltimore at this time. It was in 2015. And very much unexpected. You know, we had a very hard time with Fabrice. The truth is, Camille and I were living something that was so uncommon that she was the only one that I could share it with, right? Mm-hmm. The fact of being an Olympic champion, the fact of living what we went through with Fabrice. When I'm telling what we went through is we were scared to ask what time was going to be practiced the next day, every single evening. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of tension you create, you yeah. know, on a daily basis. So so yeah, she was the only one. She was my big sister, you know. Mm. She was my big sister, really. And we came to be really, really close. And and there was this time, 6 months before she died in this car, in this helicopter accident. Mm. Where Fabrice, apparently, from what I've been told, disrespect her once more and the last time. And she's like, you know what? It's over. You know what? It's over. I quit. I'm out. I retire. And she had the best 6 months of her life. Mm. She had wow. the best 6 months of her life. And suddenly it was just like, boom, stop. Mm. Nothing anymore. So when the news arrived, it's actually my coach at the time that's calling me early in the morning, be like, okay, I don't want you to learn it from anybody else. Here's what happened. I'm gonna fetch you, and you know, I'm coming with a car, and we're going to practice. But there's gonna be a lot of journalists around, people that want your opinion on the matter. So let's just you know, go directly inside of the pool. And so it was like this for 3 days, three consecutive days. People sieging the swimming pool just to have a word from me, and me telling them like, I don't want to talk about it. I don't know what to say. Well, at least you know what I have to say. You know how I feel. So just respect that, right? So and from this exact point, it became super hard to go to practice. Because I felt like you know, when you're thinking so much about somebody, it's like you see them everywhere, even where they're not, right? And so every time I'm going to the pool, I'm seeing her, you know, thinking about her, and it was really hard. It was really hard. But then I tried to, you know, toughen up to hold things together, and I qualified to the I'm going to the nationals. It's going so, but I'm getting qualified for the world in Kazan. And then it's one thing after another. It's like I had a bad relationship ship that ended at this exact time, getting sick again, rather badly. And this feeling inside of me that probably has to do with all of this, that, you know, like she had 6 months of her life of exact freedom. So maybe she was made to be an Olympian, but maybe she also deserved the right to enjoy her life more than what she did. And I was like, why not me? You know, why not me? And so I was like, you know what? It's enough. I'm not going to the to worlds. I'm taking time for myself. I'm taking a month and a half, 2 months off, which is the least I should have done after the Olympics. Mm. We took no days off. We took, 15 days, 3 weeks, which was just nothing. We should have taken 6 months swimming, just like super little, but staying in shape. But you know, at some point when you leave something like this and you're going for 4 more years, you have time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm not going to the world championships. And instead I'm, you know, there's a famous TV ad on in France that's the equivalent of the Super Bowl, Powerball, sorry, yeah. Powerball. And it's like this, two people that have a globe in front of them, you know, a planet sphere, and they're like, you know, making it spin, and like, where are we going right now? We're going there, and they're pointing, and they're like, Australia again? Oh no! Like, and I had my brother next to me at this point. I was like, you know what? I need some time off. I need to just fly away. and just choose. So we make the exact same thing as in the ad, and we choose to go to Asia for 2 months. And I just take one ticket in, one ticket back, and we stayed there and just went everywhere in Asia for 2 months, and it was probably one of the best time of my life as well. Wow. So then I come back, and the last year of my career wasn't hard, because I was trying hard, but I had no energy left. Just had no energy left. So maybe I should have left for, I don't know, 6 months, a year, something like this, but I have nothing left. So, and there was something else on my mind. I always wanted to stop early enough so that I wouldn't be, you know, imprisoned in the world of sports, which is one of my passion. It's a world I love, but I was curious about so many things aside that. To me, it was a torture to think that I don't have any degree, you know? So that's the way it works in France. You have to know that it's the way it works in France. You can do both at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. Same Australia,
right? So I dreamed of going to the US, and I dream of being American. And right now I would boast about, I don't know, having some kind of a degree from, I don't know, like, anywhere, Berkeley, you know, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Or sure. Auburn. Who knows?
Yeah. Who knows? it sounds like, look, a lot of people have questions on why did he stop? Why did he stop so early at the age of 24? It doesn't make sense to a lot of people, but when you hear your story, when you hear your perspective, it makes a great deal of sense to me. This seems like it had, little bit more than just a little bit of an effect on you. This had more of a major effect on you, the death of Camille.
Well, it was actually, I have to take it a little before. So the end of my time in Nice happens in 2013, and it's just too much. Fabrice is not showing up to practice. Doesn't give a shit, takes the la grosse tête, as we say in French, you know. It just gets a little dizzy with all the fame and everything, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, it was already hard as a relationship with him, with us actually being successful, but this year we're going, you know, like we're driving right into the wall, right? Mm. So it was hard enough, and I was like, okay, well, it's over. Like I quit. I feel like I need a break, like a long term break. Mm. And you know how it ended, this 7 to 8 years of relationship. Oh. He just shook my hand and be like, well, good luck. And that was it.
That's it.
That was it.
Goodbye.
That was it. Goodbye. I was like, wow. Okay. Well, not that I expected more than this, but okay. Well, so then I really thought that I was done with swimming and I was gonna catch up on my study, right? Mm. But I was kind of sad that this was the way that things should have ended, and you know that I didn't take the time to experience another philosophy, another way of actually mm-hmm. conceiving sports, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm talking with my friends, and especially with one of my close friends. Her name is Sophie. She's a former Olympian as well. And she was like, hey, so no coach in France is fine by your standards, but what about the States? And I'm like, okay, why not, you know? And she was like, who in your opinion would be, you know, a cool coach? And I was like, well, maybe Bob Bowman, but what would he think of this, like, little white dude, you know, French, coming to the States? Like, he's not even gonna answer to me. He's not gonna answer anything if I send him a message, you know.
Like, you are Olympic champion, my friend.
Well, so that's the thing with being an Olympic champion. Every time I look at myself swimming, etc., on TV, it doesn't feel like it's me that's in there, you know. Mm. I'm still proud of what I did, but it doesn't feel Like it's me, you know.
Wow.
I grew up watching the Olympics, and it always has some kind of a mystery, you know, like around it. So
yeah, like that can't be me. So that must have been somebody else.
Yeah, yeah, you know, exactly. And so Sophie was like, "Hey, why not?" I was like, "Okay, why not?" I'm sending him a private message on Twitter. Saying like, "Hey, Bob, hello. Well, I would like to talk to you if possible ever and see you, just, you know, just like talking like this, having your opinion on something." And he was like, "Okay, well, I'm in Colorado right now, you know, in the training camp in the, from the Olympic team, etc." Mm-hmm. It was like, maybe in 2 weeks or 3 weeks. I was like, no, I'm here in 3 days. I'm coming. It was like, okay, wow. Okay, perfect. Let's do that. And so I'm going to Colorado with my best friend and one guy from the Federation that didn't speak English. It was so funny. And we get there, we get in Colorado Springs in the middle of nowhere, being like, okay, ready to meet Bob Bowman. So I'm having a conversation with him for 2 to 3 hours. And I was like, wow, this is exactly my vision of sports in general. Mm. And this is the exact way I conceive it. And I should have done that way before, but I still don't feel ready to go back to in the water. So I was like, okay, Bob, well, maybe what we can do is I'll give you my answer. Maybe I'll start to swim again in the weeks to come. But like, if you give just like a few pages, not more, maybe 1500, I don't want more than this, you know. And he was super smart back then. He was like, no, take your time, you know, very wise. You refocus on yourself and get some rest, et cetera, et cetera. But it would be cool to have you here. And I was like, no. I'm staying home with my parents. I haven't seen them for so long. It's like, I need this family time. And I need to be in France and just cool down, you know?
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, well, let's do that. And we'll see. We'll see what the future brings. I am stepping down from the plane in Paris. And my agent calls me being like, "Yannick, there's like 50 journalists waiting for you to answer on why you are actually going to train with Bob Bowman." I was like, wow, information travels very fast. And I was more than anything, I was pissed at one journalist from the biggest newspaper, sports newspaper in France that had the phone number of Bob and that just, you know, kept calling him and be like, hey, is Yannick going? So I held a conference with everybody being like, hey, so you know that if I went to the States, it's not because I wanted to buy some new pair of shoes and they actually have my size, you know. Nobody laughed. Nobody. I was like, wow, this is super tense. And so I said what I had to say. And the only bad things that I said about Fabrice was that I was out because he lacked of, what did I say again? Of sincerity. Mm. That's exactly what I said. I said he lacked of sincerity. And everybody was like, whoa, that's the big clash. And they were like putting our head one onto the other, you know, on the front page of the newspapers and everything. It went like super big. Mm. For nothing. And I didn't want to take things in public, you know. So in the end I was like, well, Bob, I think we're into it now. Like I might try to swim a little bit more. So I swim just a little bit. And then after a while, I'm like, hey, or maybe it's Bob saying like, hey, don't you want to come to Baltimore? Like there's going to be a group. It's going to be Connor Dwyer. You know, it's like super fun. A lot of other people, maybe Michael's going to be here. I don't know. I was like, okay, well, I'm coming. So I'm coming for like a very small training camp. And every day went better and better and better. And so the first day I was like, well, maybe I'm going to swim you know, the relay to have my team in France. It would be nice. I feel like I can do it. Then the next day was like, hey, maybe I think I can swim two relays I can swim the 100 and the 200. It might be great, you know. And the third day, I was like, hey, actually, I'm going to swim everything. I'm going to swim the 100, the 200, everything. Okay, let's do that. And so that's the way it went. And so the next year, next season, I'm going to Baltimore. And there was something that I wish somebody told me that I didn't expect. It is that in America, like when I was in France, I was really driven, you know, very structured. I knew what I had to do. And there was always either Fabrice or anybody to tell me, like, stop it, you're doing too much. Uh-huh. Because that's how I am. Like when you tell me you go 100, I go 200. Mm-hmm. And there was nobody. Because in the States, you have your paper with your training, and at least that's how it went. And I always did the best I could. Yeah. But I have another problem. It is that I felt like, I don't know, life was giving me a second chance in my career, and I couldn't miss it, you know. So I was training like 200% all the time. I remember at some point, Bob was telling me like, wow, Yannick, it's been, I don't know, 27 years of coaching. I've never seen that in my life. I was like, There's Michael, calm down. You know, I'm sure you've seen things, right? But yeah, I went.
I will say this. I called Connor Yeager. Well, actually, I text Connor about 2 hours ago before I started this conversation with you. I said, hey, I've got Yannick on... podcast
yeah,
coming up.
I
did. Okay. So he called me straight away. He's like, I love Yannick, man. That guy's a beast. He trains like an animal. And I was like, I've seen him do. He's like, I've never seen anybody do some things that he's done in practice, man. He's like, he could do incredible things. So I'm like, he's a big fan, man. That guy loves you.
But I love him. I love him so much too. Like, we had so much fun in Baltimore, because he wasn't from Baltimore, obviously. He was coming same as me, and I mean, we were super close. I don't regret these moments, but I wish we had more occasions to spend time with each other. But with the virus, it's a bit hard right now, right? But yeah, he's a real brother, really. He's my American brother, and so we had sessions. I remember one, maybe you do that too. It was in yards, and it was 50 times 100, something like this, in a pyramidal way, or maybe, you know, like from 10 to 10 to 10 to 10. And there was, at some point, we had 5 seconds of free time in the wall and going again, you know. And after this exact set, everybody was out, I think, except me. I went all out. I did things. I can't remember exactly. Maybe if you have the occasion one day, tell Bob about this exact set, because this is the only one I remember. And I remember it was an epic thing.
Yeah.
It was something I'm not sure many things in the world could
have. Just out of your mind. Yeah. Sure.
Right.
So, yeah, I'll check with Bob on that one. But yeah, that's what Connor said. Connor Dwyer said to me, he's like, Brett, Yannick had a willingness to throw his body into a workout, into a race. Like, you know, most people are afraid, right? But he said you had this willingness to just commit everything into something, which most people couldn't get to that point.
Well, maybe, I don't know. Well, what I knew back then was that, you know, we had one of the best crew in the entire world. Like, what chance do you get in your life to swim in a group that has, back then, because it was before 2016, 21 or 23 gold medals at the Olympics, right? Mm-hmm. I remember this one day, we're in the pool. And it's kind of a public pool, you know, in Baltimore. It's kind of like Rocky style, right? So there's this grandma coming up to Bob, and she's like, hey, I wanted to ask you, do you know, maybe, like, hypothetically, can one of these young people ever go, like, I know I'm getting out of my way, but to the Olympics, maybe? And he was like pointing at every one of us being like, he's an Olympic champion. She's an Olympic champion. He's an Olympic champion. She's an Olympic champion. Like the entire crew was crazy, you know? So, and so I felt like I had no right to go less than 100% all of the time. And sure. And the thing is, you weren't babysitted as much as in France, where yeah. everybody was telling you like, slow down or stop it, or I just stopped training, et cetera, et cetera. And I started injuring myself, you know, on the shoulder, everything, because it wasn't as technical as what we would do in France and yeah. with more kilometers to be swum. So it was different in that way. And then I didn't sleep a lot back in the days. Like I always had struggle with sleeping at you know, early, let's say. But then was the maximum. So yeah. it was an addition of a lot of things that led me one day to be like I wake up one morning and I felt like instead of being 100%, I could only be like 70 anymore. Mm. And that was my glass roof, you know?
Yeah.
So,
Bob's a tough coach, and Bob's a good man. There's no doubt about it, but I wouldn't necessarily put him in the category of a nurturing coach, let's say. So you came from a tough coach, you went to a tough coach. Do you ever feel like you could have done well with somebody that was a little bit more nurturing to you, maybe who went to dinner with you or got to, you know, went to the movies with you or just got to know you as a person more, or, you know, more of a nurturing coach, somebody that was just there for you? Do you think you could have done well under those circumstances?
Oh, I think I would have done maybe 10 years without anybody beating me on the 200.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I kind of feel the same way.
Fabrice went to my apartment once when I was 14 or 15, and that was it. Never went to get a coffee with him, yeah. never went yeah. to the restaurant with him.
Yeah.
So, and I felt like, you know, the medal is important, but what you really remember from the journey, what not the other people remember. The other people remember the medal, but what you remember is the story that you have with all the people, and especially the coach. The relationship is super important. Like I've been watching this show Cobra Kai on Netflix, that is the, you know, the following of Karate yeah, Kid and everything yeah. and the relationship that the main character has with Master Miyagi, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows is the kind of relationship that everybody wants. Yeah. That's somebody that's leading you with advice through life. Mm. But life is not only about sports.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, performance is about all of the rest, because at this level, everybody is actually practicing and swimming with same intensity and almost same technicality. What really matters and makes the difference is the little details that you have around. Like, do you sleep early? Do you eat well and in a balanced way? What's up with your life on the mm, side, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I definitely regret that. I regretted it the day I went out of Nice. Like, this is one of the things that I pointed out, you know? It could have ended in a better way, but Fabrice refused to call me and tell me like, hey, let's go grab a cup of coffee and yeah. and talk about what happened. He sure. refused it. He refused it, and I heard it on the phone. It was like, mm-hmm. no way. Yeah. Yannick is like crystal now. He's not gonna win the world champs in Barcelona, so I don't want him back on the group anymore. I was like, what?
Wow.
Okay.
Well, but did you get anything different from Bob? Was there
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I remember this one time, and maybe if Bob hears this, he's gonna laugh. But to me, it was like he doesn't know how much it meant to me back then. So we have this training. So you have to know something. I'm French, okay? So it means I complain. Mm-hmm. Okay, I go on strikes. and I complain all the time, and I tell jokes, and I'm like, you know. And I felt the Frenchest of the French when I went to the States that I could actually complain, and everybody was like, oh, he's French, so he has the right to complain, you know? I felt like there was something pouring out of me, you know? And so I would do that all the time. But there was this one time I was really injured. Like my shoulder couldn't move anymore. Like I was really like, if I kept doing this, I would be out for months.
Yeah.
So I was like, Bob, I'm going out of the water. I cannot swim anymore. It's just like, it's too much. Okay. And unexpectedly, Bob had a cup of coffee from Starbucks, I guess, something like this, in his hands. And he's like throwing the cup of coffee, being like, fuck, I'm out. And he walks out of practice. And I was like, no, I'm the one that should be super angry right now. and I turned to all the other people in the group, and I'm like, hey, sorry guys, well, Bob is not gonna be here. I think I messed up. And and you know, it's the kind of stuff that happens, right, when you're in a group like this at super like high intensity training. But then I feel bad for the rest of the day, and I receive, for the very first time in my life, you hear me? Very first time in my life, a text of my coach saying, hey, like maybe I overreacted, you know, earlier during the day. I'm sorry. I know you give 100% of what you do, et cetera, et cetera. And like, I don't remember what I answered, but Bob, if you hear this, you know that this meant like the world to me, because it's the very first time that I received a message of consideration from my coach. Like it's insane to think about this right now, now that I'm out of the swimming world really, and I know what real life is about, right? More or less. But so yeah, to answer your question, it definitely is. I'm sure that like, maybe it's not the kind of the kind of people that I dragged around me that I actually, you know, like was fascinated with when I was a kid, but I could have definitely used somebody that understood that there was something more important than sport and that would share something on the side. But I know Bob is a little bit like this sometimes, somehow.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. But, well, listen, mate, You're 28, you know. Is there any chance that one day you would swim again, or is it completely gone?
Okay, so generally when somebody asks me this, I always say, hey, I never say never, because I don't want to be taken for a fool if I ever go back in the water. But to be very honest, I'm so happy with my life right now, and so fulfilled with what I live on a daily basis, that I don't see myself going back in. Or maybe if I do it, it has to be for a very, very good reason. And
ISL, what about ISL?
Well, I'm not motivated by money, or I like the new aspect of it. The way they're rethinking the races, it's super nice. It's way more telegenic. Than before, and I really felt too that it deserved to be a bit, you know, dépoussiéré, as we say in French, you know, you take off the dust a bit. By the very last years of my career, I started speaking with some of the European people, and even Michael actually, about forming a swimmers union and making it, you know, kind of the ATP in swimming, and being like, you know what, Michael, we're always pissed about the fact that every time we're going to a meet, you and I are the only ones that are basically tested, you know, like for doping. Like you want to go
Okay. Yeah, we'll just jump back in on that question again. So,
sure, go. Sure. So yeah, I was talking about it with a few, just as a, you know, throwing an idea with a few European swimmers, and even with Michael. Michael was I talked about it a few years back, And the thing was, you know, when you're just not content with everything that happens, you know, with the doping system, that is not enough. Like, we go to every meet and we are the only two guys tested every time that we arrived in a at any destination for a meet. It's just not fair, you know.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know what? Maybe if one day you want to change the rules, you can do it like ATP style, like in tennis, and we go and we create our own circuit and stuff like this. So it's not exactly the same program here, but I believe that ISL can do good to the swimming world. I firmly believe so. So I'll be watching, definitely. But to answer your very first question, I had a hard time, you know, when you just drop out of an entire world, you feel like there's going to be a continuity and people are going to be still the same towards you and you're going to see them, et cetera, et cetera. It's absolutely nonsense. Reality is, from the day you stop, nobody's calling you anymore because you're not part of the circle anymore. So you have to create something else. And so I spent a year, a year on vacation, kind of, you know, and I'll be like, okay, so I'm going to do this and this and that and all the things that I couldn't do when I was swimming. Reality is, you know, these big weekends when you have like so many things to do, you end up doing nothing, right?
Yeah.
But that's what I did for an entire year. So so I went on trips with friends. I spent time with quality time, really, with my family. But these are the only things that I did. And then I was like, okay, so I have to give another meaning, you know, to my life now that sports is gone. So what am I to do? And it went kind of naturally. So I'm doing a lot of different things right now, but I think it's sharing with people, you know, as people from sports, as high profile athletes. I believe that we are, in French, we would say passeurs d'émotion, which is, you know, like sharers of emotions. You know, we pass emotions to people, really. Mm. We give emotions, you know, and, I felt like I wanted to do that in other areas of life too. So that's what I did. And then I figured, well, it's pretty okay to give emotions, but the thing is, I don't want to do for the rest of my life something over the fact that I realized like the fact of being an Olympic champion when I was 20, you know? Yeah. I didn't want to be stuck there. So I know that even when I'm going to be 90 years old, if I ever get there, people are going to be like, hey, champ, whatever. But I want to do something else. And I'm in the process of realizing this now. And I'm a lot into literature, into writing. And so that's what I was telling you. I'm actually writing my first novel.
Oh, wow.
I'm writing my first novel. I finished a translation of a super nice book a few weeks ago. So this is going to be my next life, I think. But as for the rest, I'm, you know, there's a flame that's burning inside of me that's never going to get extinguished. And I like it. So that's why I stay connected with the swimming world, with the sports world, with might be with swimming, with esports, you know, anything. With Paris 2024, Paris 2024.
Wow. Well, listen, incredible. I did tell somebody that I've had some contact with in terms of the ISL, you know, I would say hello to you. So there is a couple of French swimmers that you may know swimming in ISL right now. Do you have any contact with any French swimmers at all anymore?
Yeah, of course. So especially people that passed by Nice, of course, and Mulhouse, which was the last club that I swimmed in. So I swim for Charlotte Bonnet, Fantine Le Saffre, Maxime Grousset, David Aubry. All these guys, I know them.
And Beryl Guestadello?
Yeah, Beryl. She's living in the States, right?
Yeah,
she's living in Texas, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she said to say hello. She knew.
Oh yeah. Well, of course, Beryl. Wow, that's like I used to swim with her, but a very long time ago in Nice. At the very first years in Nice. So can you imagine? Awesome. That's a long time. And I'm super happy for her that she's realizing now throughout, you know, her time in the States. And I know it's been tough for her as well, you know, on many levels. So
yeah, for sure.
Super happy for her that she seems to feel happy.
Yeah,
find exactly. Her balance.
Well, listen, there's a lot of questions, I'm sure, that haven't been answered in this. And I feel like that's almost like your career a little bit. There's a lot of questions that have been answered and some that haven't. And I think that's a great way to end this because, look, as I said earlier on, you're one of the most incredible talents I've ever seen come along. I mean, your frame at 6'8" and the ability that you had in the water and your technical abilities, your endurance, everything. You seem to be the total package. And to me, it seemed like you were going to be somebody that was going to be around for 10, 15 years, just dominating the world. Mm-hmm. It didn't end up that way. And it wasn't necessary, really, because you did what you did and you gave us beauty. You gave us art. And I'm so thankful that we had you. And look, even just watching today took me back to those moments to see you perform. It was incredible. But I'm also very happy to hear that you're happy and doing other things in life.
Thank you.
Makes me very happy. So it was with great pleasure on my behalf that you did this today. So thank you very much. I appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It was a very nice conversation. It's very nice to go back and try to share with people on the inside as well.
Yeah.
And I always go back to these years with great pleasure once again.
Good.
Because it was mostly super positive things that you know, like not everybody has the chance to live. So I'm super thankful and thank you for this interview. You're actually a very nice host. Is that what we said?
yeah. Thank you. I'm trying. So hopefully we can grab coffee sometime. We see each other around the pool deck maybe. So all right, Yannick, I appreciate it. Have a great day. Okay.
Have a good one.
Bye bye.